This is Our American Stories, and every once in a while, we just bring you the best of some of our favorite shows and some of your favorites. And this one comes from For the Win's Nate Scott. You hear from him every week from USA Today. And this was the very first story we did, the lost wallet story. This is a really funny story of a lost wallet told by Nate himself.
This is a story about one of my best friends, Riley Flaherty. Riley recently lost his wallet. It's a bummer, but it happens. He was at a Wilco concert at King's Theater in Brooklyn, and after the show, he took an Uber back home to Manhattan. As soon as he got home, he realized he didn't have his wallet. Riley had a trip the next morning. He really wanted the thing, so he had the driver take him all the way back. He searched the theater, but nothing. Now it's 3 in the morning, and Riley, dejected, heads back to Manhattan. He has some cash lying around, so he's able to go on the trip, but his wallet's gone. And so he does what you do when you lose a wallet. He cancels his credit cards. He actually was waiting on a new driver's license, so he got one of those, and he bought a new wallet. End of story. Or so you'd think. Because after that, a miracle happened. Well, a sort of miracle. A very New York miracle. 2 weeks after he lost his wallet, Riley received a plain white envelope in the mail. His name was written in shaky handwriting on it, and inside was his license, his credit cards, and a note. The note read, "Dear Riley Flaherty, I found your wallet, and your driver's license had your address, so here's your credit cards and other important stuff. I kept the cash because I needed weed, the Metro card because, well, the fare's $2.75 now, and the wallet because it's kind of cool. Enjoy the rest of your day. Toodles. Anonymous." I've never been so conflicted about a nice gesture, Riley told me. The cash, gone. The wallet, gone. The Metro card, gone. But 2 weeks later, returned in a plain white envelope, a driver's license, and his credit cards. "I had already gone to get a new license, and had already gotten all my cards replaced," said Riley. "So basically, it was useless to me." He did have this story, though, and no one can take that away from him.
And no, you can't. And of course, we always get asked for the shower thoughts, and this is Jesse channeling his Stephen Wright. And so now we bring you one of your favorites.
Shower thoughts.
People shouldn't be allowed to use the bathroom on an airplane for flights lasting under 2 hours. If you can't hold it for that long, too bad. I'm sorry your mommy didn't teach you any self-control. I'd like to think that money wouldn't change who I am, but when I'm winning Monopoly, I become a terrible person. If organized crime started printing high-quality counterfeit college textbooks and then sold them at cut-rate prices, it'd be a really good public relations move. If pigs could fly, I bet their wings would taste delicious. When boarding an airplane, first-class passengers are forced to sit at eye level with the coach passengers' crotches as they board. Airlines could solve this problem by letting first class board last. Sometimes pets are better than children. They eat less, they don't ask for money, and if they get pregnant, you can just sell their babies. Dog food could say it's any flavor it wants to. You're not going to test it. When I was a small kid, my grandma used to show me love by playing along with my make-believe games. Now that she's older and has dementia, it's my turn to show love by playing along with hers. If you accuse someone of being argumentative, they can't disagree with you without proving your point. Why would anybody buy a bookmark for a dollar when they could use a dollar for a bookmark? According to most ghost photos, our clothes must have a soul too, otherwise all ghosts would be photographed naked. The kind of people who close the shade on an airplane window should be placed on a terrorist watch list and not be allowed to fly. These people are the last kind of soul-sucking vampires I would want to die with if, God forbid, the plane went down in flames over the sun-scorched desert. Shouldn't billboards be illegal since they distract you from the road? If you wash the dirt from a fallen ice cube, you're washing your water with water and hope that there's only water on the water that you will add to your water.
Shower thoughts.
Thanks for that, Jesse. Mm-hmm. And we love taking you down the road with certain artists, and we feature them for a half hour, an hour. And we did an hour on Martin Scorsese and got into that Latz Catholic guilt he talked about often in that hour. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and look up Martin Scorsese in our This Day in History. And by the way, we looked up this guy's films. You name the letter in the alphabet. A, Age of Innocence. C, Casino. Color of Money, Cape Fear. D, The Departed. G, Goodfellas, Gangs in New York. K, King of Comedy. R, Raging Bull. T, Taxi Driver. W, Wolf of Wall Street. It's crazy. Well, here he is at the Kennedy Center talking about film, because so many people think film and the arts are silly. Scorsese had a different point of view.
Whenever I hear people dismiss movies as fantasy, I make a hard distinction between film and life. I think to myself that it's just a way of avoiding the power of cinema. I mean, of course it's not life. It's the invocation of life. It's an ongoing dialogue with life. Frank Capra said, film is a disease. He went on, but that's enough for now. I caught the disease early on, you know. I used to feel it. They used to take me to the movies all the time. I used to feel it whenever we walked up to the ticket booth, my mother and my father and my brother. You go through the doors and the thick carpet to the past the popcorn stand where it had that wonderful smell, then to the ticket taker. And then sometimes they get these doors would open in the back, and there were little windows in it in some of these old theaters, and I could see something magical happening up there on the screen, something special. And as we entered, for me, I think now it was like entering a sacred space, kind of a sanctuary where the living world around me seemed to be recreated and played out.
Storytelling isn't life, it's the invocation of life. That's what we try to do here on Our American Stories. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories, and we love music, and we spend at least 10 to 15% of our time on music. And the Wall Street Journal has a remarkable piece every Friday in their personal journal called Playlist. And one particular playlist was written by historian Elizabeth Fenn, a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer. And Playlist is all about a song and how it impacted a person. And the person then writes about this song and how it affected their life. Elizabeth Fenn recorded her piece for us.
I first heard These Are Days by 10,000 Maniacs during a walkabout period in my life. In the mid-1980s, I dropped out of grad school at Yale and spent 8 years working as an auto mechanic at several North Carolina garages. Back then, I needed a new challenge and wanted to be with my partner, who became my husband. He taught at Duke University, where I had studied as an undergraduate. I've always liked metal and machines and decided to attend a community college nearby to learn how to fix cars. After a year, I took a job at a garage attached to a dealership. I loved mixing it up with the guys and having knockdown arguments about life. At the garage, my fellow mechanics argued constantly about country and rock radio stations and which ones to listen to. I had no opinion, since I enjoyed both. One day in 1992, These Are Days came on the rock station. The song with Natalie Merchant singing had just been released and captured my existence. Days in the shop were hard, working in 100-degree heat, smashing my knuckles and breaking bolts. The song by Robert Buck and Ms. Merchant reminded me to appreciate what was going on around me. These are days you'll remember, never before and never since, I promise, will the whole world be warm as this. Never.
The whole world be warm as this.
lyrics simultaneously expressed a realness and sense of loss, urging me to savor the present. The great thing about fixing cars is that you can go home at night, drink beer, and read. Around 1994, I read The Horseman on the Roof by Jean Giono. It's a 1951 novel set during the European cholera pandemic of 1832. The book inspired me to re-enroll at Yale, where I finished my history degree and wrote my first book, Pax Americana, The Great Smallpox Epidemic of 1775 to 82. Today, I teach at the University of Colorado Boulder and often bike 17 miles to campus. These Are Days is still on my iPod, but when it pops on, I'm not transported back to the garage. Instead, I'm reminded to look around at the mountains and experience the moment.
And we thank Elizabeth Fenn for that great reading. We also took a little trip down a Billy Joel lane. We spent a half hour on his life. And the guy sold 150 million records. He sold out Madison Square Garden more than anyone. Grew up in a small town in Long Island and dreamed of one day playing in the garden. His intellectual property, and that is the value of the artistic work. And by the way, that's preserved by the U.S. Constitution. Only in America is a song considered property. And the artists of this country benefit from that. And that could be worth a half $1 billion. Well, Billy Joel was performing a master class at the University of Pennsylvania. And we know the management of Joel's great team and the head manager, and we got permission to use this. And Joel was lecturing about the business of the music business, how to do it, how to write a song, how to sell the song, and then how to play, tour, and all the rest. In other words, how to monetize what you're doing, how to make it a business. And he said, of course, the word business is in the music business. Well, at the end, he was being asked questions by the audience, and there was one master piano and Master Steinway Grand on the stage, and a young lady got up and asked about a song, and she may have been 23 or 24, but she wanted to know about the song Lullaby. And, well, here's what Joel had to say about that song.
All right, so I had this melody. Which is how I write songs. I wrote the music first. She goes, "Daddy, what happens when you die?" So I said, "Oh, man. Whew. Okay." And I told her what I really believed. And what I really believe is, what happens when you die is you go into other people's hearts, that you never really go away. You go into the rest of the people that you knew. You go into the rest of their lives. They take them with you. So, but also this was during a time when her mom and I were splitting up. So this was like a double-pronged thing, like, "Daddy, are you going to leave me?" And I said, "I'll never leave you. I will never leave you. I'll never go away. I will never, never, ever leave you."
And you could see Joel choking up, because this wasn't Madison Square Garden. It was an intimate venue, and there was no band. And so he takes a breath, and then here's the answer to his little girl's question. Here's the first verse and chorus of Lullaby.
Questions for another day. I think I know what you've been asking me. I think you know what I've been trying to say. I promised I would never leave you, and you should always know. Never will be far away.
And Joel, well, he starts to tear up, and he just has a little bit of a breakdown because it's so personal to him. It's bringing him back. "Yeah, I have seen him play many times. I never saw him explain the song before. Daddy, what happens when I die? And Daddy, are you going to leave me?" Well, after tearing up, drying it off, he comes back plays the second verse, and then closes things out with this final and stunning verse, tying the whole song and the loop together for his baby girl.
Good night, my angel, now it's time to dream. And dream how wonderful your life will be. Someday your child may cry, and if you sing this lullaby, then in your heart there will always be a part of me. Someday we'll all be gone, but lullabies go on and on. They never die, that's how you and I will.
And if you've ever had a little girl and sung her a lullaby, you're tearing up now or you don't have a heart. And Joel went on to talk about how he wrote Piano Man. He went on to talk about the record business and the state of the business, agents, managers. And in the end, he talked about risk-taking. And he talked about failure and rejection. And just as Robert De Niro, who you're about to hear from later in his commencement speech at NYU, was telling that audience, don't take it personally. Rejection is a part of the business. And in fact, dare to fail. And by the way, isn't that what every entrepreneur in America says? Talk to them about their biggest failures. They'll tell you those were the times they learned the most. And there you have it. This is Our American Stories. We love music. We've done, wow, Robert Plant, an hour. Kurt Cobain's will kill you. And Duane Allman's is my favorite. And we go out with one of our favorite Billy Joel songs. What a story. About fishing on Long Island, the Downeaster Alexa. More after these messages.
Reluctantly crouched at the starting line. Engines pumping and thumping in time. The green light flashes, the flags go up. Churning and burning, they yearn for the cup. They deftly maneuver and muscle for rank. Fuel burning fast on an empty tank. Reckless and wild, they pour through the turns. Their prowess is potent and secretly stern. As they speed through the finish, the flags go down. The fans get up and they get out of town. The arena is empty, except for one man still driving and striving as fast as he can. The sun has gone down and the moon has come up. And long ago somebody left with the cup. But he's driving and striving and hugging the turns and thinking of someone for whom he still burns. He's going the distance.
This is Our American Stories, and we want to go into our American Dreamers segment, brought to us, as always, by the folks at Job Creators Network. And they're out there working hard for small business owners across this country, the driving force of the American economy. And we wanted to start with a guy who you wouldn't think is a small business owner, and he was. His name is Mario Andretti. And let's just say this about him, because I think there's only one stat I need to read, and that is he was named the driver of the century by both the American Motor Association and AP. Not a bad title. I don't think I need to read anything else. We caught up with Mario because his story is remarkable. He came from Italy when Italy lost in the war before it won. Well, they had some problems negotiating after 1945, and Yugoslavia took over a part of Italy that his father owned a family vineyard in for centuries. It had been in the family for centuries. And he couldn't say yes to Tito. So he gave up the vineyard. The family lived in a displaced person's home for 7 years, comes to America, but Mario Andretti reaches the heights of auto racing. And here's what he had to say about being born in America.
I feel that I'm a true, true example of the American dream. I don't see how anything could have happened to me unless we came to the States. Even under the environment that my dad had me under, you know, because of his, you know, this farming and so, I didn't want to do that. I had no, you know, even as a youngster, I just despised that type of thing. You know, that's not what, you know, set the fire in me. And, you know, we loved my Uncle Bruno, you know, who was, you know, my mother's brother, you know, who was, you know, he was an aviator in the aviation. He was he had motorcycles. He had, you know, was that type of a guy, you know. And so there was something that, as I say, just if we would have remained there, I probably, I don't know, I probably would have become a plumber or something.
Yeah. Now, we love asking folks just a few questions, Mario, just personal ones. Your biggest regret, that is the decision you made that you wish you could have pulled back in your life.
Well, you know, I'm not sure that I have any regrets, quite honestly. You could always do something better, you mm-hmm. know, by looking at it now. Okay, I might have made a better decision a different time. I'll give you an example. You know, when at the end of, you know, my Formula One career with Lotus, I had a couple of opportunities, one to go either with McLaren or Alfa Romeo. And I went with my heart. You know, I went with Alfa Romeo because, you know, I had a friend, engineer there and so forth, and I thought Alfa Romeo was ready to spring, you know, into the to the top in Formula One, and instead I could have gone with McLaren. I could have probably won another world championship with McLaren. So, you know, those are some things you call it a mistake, call it miscalculation. Yeah, you could, you know, now that I have a chance to revisit, but overall, Lee, I have no regrets. I have no regrets whatsoever. You know, the positive way overcome the negatives. And so I, again, no regrets.
That's great. What gives you, Mario, at this stage of your life, your deepest sense of fulfillment?
The deepest sense of fulfillment is to be able to, with everything that's going on in my career and the distractions and everything, to have been able to keep the family together throughout.
Yeah, and faith, does that play a role in your life, Mario? I mean, we know you're Catholic, but talk about that part of your life.
Faith does. Not just the fact that we had a priest in our family that was clergy, that was never anything that was really pushed on us. As a matter of fact, my uncle priest, I love that man more than anyone. He was such a modern thinker and everything, even then. It was just that there was another chaplain in our camp, Lorenzo Tambellini, who somehow, without forcing things, he instilled certain values, you know, that you maintain and keep, and always knowing that you can't do things alone. You know, you need some help, whether it's, you know, it's an abstract from upstairs or something. You know, you have to invoke something, believe in something, and I do. And many times I said, you know, I need some help here, please, you know. And somehow it works for you. It always did, and it always will.
And last but not least, Mario, tell us about a hobby, a pastime, a secret passion that the audience might not expect Mario Andretti to have.
Well, hobbies, I mean, that's what we do. I just love recreation, and as you can imagine, I'm fortunate that we have a place up in the Poconos here. I have a lake, and I have every toy imaginable, you know, ATVs, I have boats, I have ultralight. We play tennis, we water ski. I just love all the things that, you know, they're energetic. And you ought to come up there. I'll get you tired really fast.
And I'm not going because he'll wear me out. The man, the boy, still the same, the love for speed. He couldn't wait to get off that farm. We heard the same story from Henry Ford. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and listen to that hour. It is special. We also did an hour on Levi Strauss. And we did that thanks to Out Where the West Begins by Phil Anschutz and several other folks involved with the Strauss Company, the Levi Strauss Company. Let's take a listen to an excerpt of that hour.
It is here in Manhattan where jeans boutiques are lined up one after the other. Loeb Strauss began his unstoppable rise to become one of the greatest American industrialists. On January 24th, 1848, gold is discovered in Northern California.
One of us needs to take a first-hand look at the market out there.
Phil Anschutz writes in Out Where the West Begins that Strauss planned to get rich by exploiting market forces instead of prospecting for gold. During the gold rush era, he writes, there were more prospectors than there were tents, shovels, pickaxes, buckets, and pans. The state of California was completely settled within 3 years.
Well, then what are we waiting for?
For you to go to California.
But before Loeb Strauss went west, he became an American citizen. He swore an oath to the American Constitution and renounced the Bavarian king forever. At about the same time, he started going by the name of Levi Strauss. Here again is Hesia Diner.
So for this young man to come and want to be able to communicate with his customers, to say I'm Loeb Strauss may have been more difficult than to say I'm Levi Strauss. I'm not sure I'd want to say that this was a step towards assimilation, because he's keeping his Hebrew name, but it's a way of adaptation to the American circumstance.
Levi Strauss took a steamship from New York City through Panama and at 24 years of age opened for business as a wholesale trader to the San Francisco gold miners in 1853.
It's a remarkable story. Again, go to Our American Story. Go to This Day in OurAmericanNetwork.org. Go to This Day in History. Pull it down. I think we got about 75 segments. Levi Strauss is right about in the middle. And when we come back, more stories, including the story that Robert De Niro told the graduates at NYU last year about how to make it in almost any line of work. More after these messages. This is Our American Stories, and this past May, we ran through commencement speeches almost every night. Old ones, sort of new ones, mostly great ones, and by the way, one really terrible one, which was so terrible.
That
it was
awesome.
It was awesome. It was funny it was so terrible. And so you can go on OurAmericanNetwork.org and just get into the, go back about a month and a half, and just scroll down. I mean, the commencement speeches are a who's who of America. And Denzel Washington's was spectacular. spectacular. And he emphasized things like hard work, faith, and family. And my goodness, faith was at the dead center of his speech. It was beautiful. Steve Jobs, really legendary speech at Stanford. We have that. And Admiral McCravens at the University of Texas. Peter Paces, General Peter Pace. My goodness, that one at Citadel was just terrific. And what we're going to play you now is a short clip from Robert De Niro's commencement speech at the Tisch School of Arts at NYU last year.
On this day of triumphantly graduating, a new door is opening for you. A door to a lifetime of rejection. It's inevitable. It's what graduates call the real world. You'll experience it auditioning for a part or a place in a company. It'll happen to you when you're looking for backers for a project. You'll feel it when doors close on you while you're trying to get attention for something you've written and when you're looking for a directing or a choreography job. How do you cope with it? I hear that Valium and Vicodin work. I don't know. You can't be too relaxed and do what we do. And you don't want to block the pain too much. Without the pain, what will we talk about? Rejection might sting, but my feeling is that often it has very little to do with you. When you're auditioning or pitching, the director or producer or investor may just have something or someone different in mind. That's just how it is. That happened to me recently when I auditioned for the role of Martin Luther King in Selma. Which was too bad because I could have played the hell out of that part. I felt it was written for me. But the director had something different in mind. And you know, she was right. It seems the director is always right.
And he went on to just talk about that none of it is personal. The rejection isn't personal. Don't take it personal. There just might have been someone better for that role. And don't take it personally, and don't get angry, and don't cry, because that same director might be auditioning your butt 8 years from now, and he'll remember you for your whining nature. So just buck up. Go to the next one. Next. He hit that word over and over again. Next. Next. Next audition. Next up, this is a letter that went positively viral on the web. It was a letter entitled, "To My Daughter with Down Syndrome on Her Wedding Day." The father, Paul Doherty, shares that super viral letter to his daughter for us.
Dear Jillian, it is the afternoon of your wedding, June 27th, 2015. In 2 hours, you will take the walk of a lifetime, a stroll made more memorable by what you've achieved to get to this day. I don't know what the odds are of a woman with Down syndrome marrying the love of her life. I only know you've beaten them. You are upstairs now, making final preparations with your mom and bridesmaids. Your hair is coiled perfectly above your slender neck. Your bejeweled dress, my bling, you called it, attracts every glimmer of late afternoon sunshine pouring through the window. Your makeup, that red lipstick, somehow improves upon a beauty that has grown since the day you were born. Your smile is blooming and everlasting. I'm outside, beneath that window, staring up. We live for moments such as these, Jillian, when hopes and dreams intersect at a sweet spot in time, when everything we've always imagined arrives and assumes a perfect clarity. Bliss is possible. I know that now, standing beneath that window. I have everything and nothing to tell you. When you were born and for years afterward, I didn't worry for what you'd achieve academically. Your mom and I would make that happen. We'd wield the law like a cudgel if we had to. We could make teachers teach you, and we knew you'd earn the respect of your peers. What we couldn't do was make other kids like you, accept you, befriend you, stand with you in the vital social arena. We thought, what's a kid's life like if it isn't filled with sleepovers and birthday parties and dates to the prom? I worried about you then. I cried deep inside on the night when you were 12 and you came downstairs to declare, I don't have any friends. We all wish the same things for our children. Health, happiness, and a keen ability to engage and enjoy the world are not only the province of typical kids. Their pursuit is every child's birthright. I worried about your pursuit, Jillian. I shouldn't have. You're a natural when it comes to socializing. They called you the mayor in elementary school for your ability to engage everyone. You danced on the junior varsity dance team in high school. You spent 4 years attending college classes and made lifelong impressions on everyone you met. Do you remember all the stuff they said you'd never do, Jills? You wouldn't ride a two-wheeler. You wouldn't play sports. You wouldn't go to college. You certainly wouldn't get married. Now, look at you. You're the nicest person I know. Someone who is able to live a life of empathy and sympathy, and without agendas or guile, is someone we all want to know. It worked out for you because of the person you are. I would tell you to give your fiancé, Ryan, your whole heart, but that would be stating the obvious. I would tell you to be kind to him and gentle with him, but you do that already, with everyone you know. I would wish for you a lifetime of friendship and mutual respect, but you two have been together a decade already, so the respect and friendship already are apparent. A decade ago, when a young man walked to our door wearing a suit and bearing a corsage made of cymbidium orchids, said, "I'm here to take your daughter to the homecoming, sir," every fear I have ever had about your life being incomplete vanished. Now you and Ryan are taking a different walk together. It's a new challenge, but it's no more daunting for you than for anyone else. Given who you are, it might be less so. Happiness comes easily to you, as does your ability to make happiness for others. I see you now. The prep work has been done. The door swings open. My little girl, all in white, crossing the threshold of yet another conquered dream. I stand breathless and transfixed, utterly in the moment. You look beautiful, is the best I can do. Jillian thanks me. I'll always be your little girl, is what she says then. Yes, you will, I manage. Time to go, I say. We have a walk to make.
And indeed, he made that walk, and Stan just showed me a picture of the beautiful bride and her dad. And what a story to my daughter with Down syndrome on her wedding day. And again, that's Paul Daugherty and his beautiful girl, his baby girl, Jillian. And again, to hear this story, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and share it with friends. Please do. And last but not least, our intrepid field reporter and producer, Alex Cortez. Well, he wanted to run down a story because he had heard that in Wisconsin, it was illegal for low prices to be too low. Let's take a listen.
In America, we're used to hearing strange news reports like this one.
Linda Carson, ABC7, would you not eat my pants? Ah!
Or this one.
Curiosity leads to large crowds in Mobile's Crichton community, many of you bringing binoculars, camcorders, even camera phones to take pictures.
To me, it looked like a leprechaun to me. I got to look up in the tree. Who else in the leprechaun say yeah? Yeah!
Eyewitnesses say the leprechaun only comes out at night. If you shine a light in its direction, it suddenly disappears.
But perhaps stranger than them all is one that Wisconsinites saw on their televisions the other day.
Low prices are part of the Meijer business model, but are they too low? The company says it's never encountered this type of situation in any other state where it operates.
You did hear that right. They said too low. Here's how a rival TV station put it.
But now the regional chain faces an unusual problem, accused of breaking Wisconsin law by offering deals that are too good.
Deals that are too good? So good that they might be illegal? When we heard this, our brains and our wallets were so unsettled that we had to find out what on earth is going on here and whether we were still even on the planet Earth. And so we asked an expert, the president of a think tank called the McIver Institute, and more importantly, Brett Healy is a Wisconsin resident and expert shopper. Brett said the law came from dead people.
Well, Wisconsin's minimum markup law is a relic from the distant past. It was originally passed back in 1939, and essentially the law makes it illegal for retailers and wholesalers to sell merchandise at a discount.
Something that Meijer says it has never encountered before.
Meyer spokesman says this is a bit peculiar for us. We're not accustomed to regulations that limit our customers' ability to save money when they shop with us.
And that may be one of the strangest stories we've done here on Our American Stories. Great work always by the whole team here. And if you want to see or hear any of our material, go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. This is Our American Stories, and that's Kurt Cobain singing, and we covered his life. He killed himself with a gun, but anyone who knew him knew it was the drugs. I have a niece who, unbeknownst to us, had been addicted to depression pills, and one night she woke up in a dark place, took a pistol, and killed herself. And it's something you never forget. And so we spend some space here because as we were trying to reconcile what happened to her, we learned so much about drug addiction and how many families and homes are affected by this. And we bumped across a piece in Life's Et, Letter to My Heroin Addict Daughter. And it was written by a mom living in Wisconsin who wrote it anonymously. We asked her to record it, and God bless her, she did.
Dear daughter, I have lost you, gone as the baby girl I held in my arms while whispering words of adoration, gone as the little girl whose fingernails I painted a soft, innocent pink while we sang, I love you, you love me. Gone for now are the dreams I had for your life as I watched you walk into your kindergarten room on that first day of school. Dashed are the hopes that swelled up in my heart when I saw you sing in your school's choral concerts, as you went out on your first date, as you walked down the aisle with your high school diploma in hand. How could I fathom I was watching you march toward the devastation called addiction? I shared in your excitement as you, with a gleam in your eyes, told me about the man that wanted to date you. This could be the one, Mom, you said. He was the one who injected a vein in your arm with your first dose of heroin. How many times he did after that, I don't know, but you were hooked. You eventually overdosed and even once clinically died. In a twisted sense of irony, he was there to resuscitate you. I'll never forget the call I got from the hospital late at night. You were there recovering, but they released you before I arrived. You ran back into his arms, and you both ran. And I began the mad search for my daughter, who had suddenly become a stranger to me. Shock turned into denial, which evolved into anger, and then unimaginable sadness and loss. My little girl was gone. The night you overdosed, I started looking for you at your house. I let myself in, only to find the police had been there before me. I saw papers strewn around your floor, drawers wide open, and your favorite childhood stuffed animal lying abandoned on the kitchen floor. Clutching it to my chest, I sobbed and slowly walked through every room. Your bedroom, where all the drugs were found, was cold. A window was open, and the frigid January wind was seeping in. Where are you? I sobbed as I left. Life would never be the same. We soon discovered it wasn't just heroin. You relied on meth and prescription pills to numb your insecurities and life's pain. I thought I could fix it all. I thought it would be simple. I had no idea what our family was up against. I eventually found you and managed to get you into treatment, thinking 6 weeks in rehab would bring you back. But I was wrong. You always went back to him, back to the needles, spoons, fine white powder, and brown liquid in your veins. The battle to get you back is far from over. It's clear to see how much the drugs have altered your old persona and brain, and I'm now dealing with a new person. Your family and friends have seen you lose weight as your health deteriorates, your body unbelievingly still functioning despite all you're doing to destroy it. We've seen you turn into a liar and a master manipulator. You've learned how to twist and turn facts and situations to where we are hanging on to the string of hope you dangle in front of us. In the beginning, we gave you money, bailed you out of drug-induced debt, gave you rides, always giving you the benefit of the doubt because we thought you were on the road to recovery. We later learned that what we were doing was called enabling. We've talked to you through jail phones with a glass partition between us. We've seen you stand in front of a judge multiple times, taking his lenient sentences. You promised you'd never go back to the drugs again. You snowballed even him. In the beginning, losing you consumed all of us. We cried every day. We couldn't put in a productive day at work. At first, our coworkers showed us sympathy and understanding, but as time wore on, even they got tired of the long journey, saying you belonged in jail. We went to support groups, but found that sharing our sorrow didn't change anything. Losing you to the drugs has been like experiencing a death. The grief has been overwhelming. I tell you this, but you look at me expressionless, worried about your next hit. If I could sit by you while you're using, I would tell you what each syringe does. This dose will send your mother into despair and fits of sobbing. Your next hit will throw your father to his knees as he cries out in pain, "What did I do wrong?" The next will saturate your little brother's pillows with tears of anguish, fear, and disappointment. And the next will rock your little sister's world as her young brain tries to comprehend the concept of addiction. You've lost your license, your car, your house, and friends. When I do get to see you, I hold you and close my eyes as I give you a kiss. For a few seconds, I feel like I'm once again kissing my little girl's smooth, soft cheek, and there is hope. But when I let go, I look into an addict's eyes, and we both know it's all changed. I don't know where it will go from here. I see you taking promising steps forward, then leaps backward. Our family's shock and sorrow have evolved into a fight to keep you off the streets and breathing. We have been dealt a devastating hand that we will never understand. But until the day I die, I will fight to get you back and live the life I dreamed for you as you were growing up. I love you, you love me, forever my baby, you'll be.
And that was a letter to my heroin addict daughter. And it was on LifeSet. And we go out with Neil Young and a song he wrote because the needle had taken so many of his friends' lives too early. And for any family who's suffering, we're praying for you. More after these messages.
I've seen the needle and the damage done. A little part of it in everyone. But every junkie's like a setting sun.
Yeah.
This is Our American Stories, and now it's time for our This Day in History segment, always brought to us by our friends at Hillsdale College, and one of the great places in this country to study all the things that matter in life, history, philosophy. And now we're about to play you a story, and it's a heck of a story, about a man you know. You've heard of him. You know where he's been. but you don't know where he's from, and you're about to hear the other side of this very well-known man's life story.
Some people call me the space cowboy, yeah. Some call me the gangster of love. Some people call me Maurice, 'cause I speak of the pompous of love.
Fighter pilot, war hero, son, MIT rocket scientist, father. He has been all these things and a lot more things, but he's mostly remembered for one thing, something he's a little tired of being asked about. After 60 years of it, you might have been too. He's also tired of it because it's not enough to him. It's something we did, he says. Now we should do something else. His name is Buzz Aldrin. And that something he did, that one thing, was being the second man to ever walk on the moon, answering his president's call of duty.
But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
You'd think his vanity license plate would be Moon Guy, yet it's Mars Guy. It's that something else he thinks we should do. Mars. Born in Montclair, New Jersey, Buzz Aldrin's mother had the maiden name Moon. Coincidence, you ask? I don't think so. His real name is Edwin, but his sister couldn't say brother. The name Buzzer just kept coming out of her mouth, and the nickname Buzz sticked. His country is glad it did. And Edwin walking on the moon is not nearly as profound as a Buzz doing so. Buzz was a Boy Scout, as so many great men are. He was also shaped by his family, in good ways and in bad.
Check ignition and may God's love be with you.
His grandfather put a bullet through his brain. His mom swallowed pills to her death. His father was almost too alive in his life. A career military man, his father knew Amelia Earhart, one of the Wright brothers, and took a transatlantic flight on the Hindenburg before it blew up. He wanted his only boy, Buzz, to be just like him, brave and brilliant. But Buzz was shy and sensitive. And he drove himself to his father's dreams for him. When he flew combat missions in the Korean War and was decorated with the Distinguished Flying Cross, his father said, "And?" And so he went to MIT and earned a doctorate of science in astronautics. These elite experiences led him to NASA, and when he walked on the moon, his dad said, "And?" The second man to walk on the moon? Number two? His father was so affected by it that he waged a one-man campaign to get the Postal Service to change its Neil Armstrong First Man on the Moon commemorative stamp to one that said First Men on the Moon, so it could include Buzz. He would lose. And Buzz would lose something much greater when he returned home. As GQ magazine put it, he discovered the melancholy of all things done. He was a conqueror with nothing left to conquer but his own demons. NASA had no more use for Buzz. They sent him around the world like a PR flak. Even though he was a scientist, his mind was left idle. Buzz resigned and returned to the Air Force, but they didn't exactly know what to do with an academic who had just been to the moon. And so Buzz picked up the bottle. He put down his marriage to the mother of his three children. He retired and went into rehab, tried out marriage again for a year, and drank some more. A Cadillac dealership sounded like a good place to go, but he didn't sell very many of them. As if it could get any worse, he created this song with Snoop Dogg.
Are you ready to put on your spacesuit? Strap in for the G-Force liftoff. Countdown is getting very close now to the adventure of a lifetime.
If his life tells us anything, it's that we are complex human beings, all with our own crosses, all capable of our own triumphs, all with a need for love in our lives, especially the love of a father and a mother. To close our tribute to Buzz Aldrin, an American great, born on this day in history in 1930, we take you to his telling of his time on the moon. First with seeing his friend Neil Armstrong becoming the first man to ever set foot on the moon.
It was absolutely correct that the captain, the commander, make the first descent and walk on the moon.
Two men from the planet Earth first set foot upon the moon, July 1969, A.D.
We came in peace for all mankind. That statement really, to me, was a very symbolic one of not just our mission, but all of the Apollo effort.
They've got the flag up now, and you can see the stars and stripes on the Olympic.
Beautiful, just beautiful. Beautiful, just beautiful.
If you look real close, you can see that I'm saluting the flag. And for a military person, that was indeed a very, very proud moment to be on the moon saluting the flag.
And then Buzz did something a little more reflective. He radioed over to NASA.
This is the LM pilot. I'd like to take this opportunity to ask every person listening in, whoever and wherever they may be, to pause for a moment and contemplate the events of the past few hours and to give thanks in his or her own way.
Ending his radio communication, he then read from the Gospel of John, chapter 15, verse 5, which says,
I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever remains in me and I in him will bear much fruit, for you can do nothing without me.
Buzz said of this verse, I read the words which I had chosen to indicate our trust that as man probes into space, we are in fact acting in Christ. I sensed especially strongly my unity with our church back home and with the church everywhere, and then took communion. Later recounting in Guidepost magazine, I ate the tiny host and swallowed the wine. I gave thanks for the intelligence and spirit that had brought two young pilots to the Sea of Tranquility. It was interesting for me to think, the very first liquid ever poured on the moon and the very first food eaten there were the communion elements. Buzz Aldrin marked his territory in his own special way, and marked what he saw as God's territory in his special way. Although NASA wouldn't let him share with the world what he had done. But in the end, who's going to stop Buzz Aldrin? At least for as long as he continues to wear jockey underwear. Jockey, supporting greatness since 1876.
This is Our American Stories. Great job by Alex and Greg. The whole team here does great work. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org. Go to This Day in History and look for this Buzz Aldrin story and so many more. This is Our American Stories. And now and then we delve into one of life's most difficult times, death. The segment is regularly called Final Thoughts. We do eulogies. We do stories about dying. It's a part of life. Sometimes, in the end, some of these segments are so darn beautiful. Sometimes they're so tragic, and sometimes they're both. This story originally appeared in the New York Times, and the headline was Doctor Smuggles a Beer for a Dying Patient. A young Dr. Daniela Lamas tells the story of her promise she intended to keep with her patient.
My pager went off late one afternoon with a message from the oncology service at my hospital, asking me to see a 70-year-old man with metastatic cancer and trouble breathing. I wasn't hopeful. I had chosen to train in pulmonary and critical care medicine because I wanted to be someone who saved lives. But it turned out there was so much sickness I couldn't fix. Vague pain led to a diagnosis of colon cancer that had traveled to his liver and lungs. Now he was short of breath and might have pneumonia. His team was asking me to arrange a procedure called a bronchoscopy, in which we insert a small tube with a camera at the end down the throat in order to look inside the lungs and suck out a deep sample to help find out what's going wrong. We'll get him on the schedule for tomorrow, I sighed, suspecting that nothing I did would make him better. No food or drink after midnight. In the waiting area outside the procedure suite the next morning, I went through the usual consent forms. He would be asleep for the procedure, thanks to sedative drugs we would run through the intravenous line. We'd make him feel pretty good, but he'd remember none of it. Just imagine a really good martini, or two or three, I joked. It was the first time I had noticed my patient smile. You know, I'm more of a Guinness man myself, he said. I remembered the first time I drank a Guinness when I visited Ireland in medical school. And I thought now of those lazy afternoons, chatting with strangers, cozy inside a dark pub while it rained outside. All right, a Guinness then, I told him reassuringly. Something to look forward to when you get home. But days passed and he was still in that hospital room. One morning, my patient's wife told me that he had decided against any more aggressive procedures. No more blood draws or chest x-rays or antibiotics. He was dying, and he didn't want to die with a breathing tube in the intensive care unit. The goal had shifted to making his remaining time as comfortable as possible. I stared at the sign, still hanging behind his bed, NPO, from the Latin nil per os or nothing by mouth, in bold black letters warning his caregivers that he wasn't allowed to eat or drink. I told the medical student I was working with that we were going on a field trip to the liquor store. Won't we get in trouble, he asked. I hope not. But I had promised my patient a beer when it was all done, and that was a promise I could keep. So that afternoon, we trooped to the liquor store across the street from the hospital and bought a cold bottle of Guinness Extra Stout, which the medical student tucked inside the pocket of his short white coat. We giggled about the bulge the smuggled beverage made in his coat as we rode the elevator back up to the patient's room. I pulled the nurse taking care of my patient into the hall and told her we had something to show her, gesturing to my medical student waiting anxiously in the corner. He slipped the bottle out from its hiding place. Okay with you? I asked the nurse. She nodded. I had given my patient's wife a heads up earlier in the day. We were ready. All right, I said, let's do it. The hospital room was abuzz with the excitement of the illicit. We closed the curtains. My patient looked calmer, awake despite the morphine and breathing a little more comfortably. His wife was sitting at his bedside awaiting our arrival. My medical student pulled the brown bag out of his coat with unexpected flourish. I figured I'd get you that Guinness I promised, I said. I held it up to the patient's wife first, who nodded encouragingly and then turned around and showed my patient. He smiled, a Guinness man after all. It was only after I struggled with the cap that I realized none of us had a bottle opener. My medical student saw me casting about, grabbed the beer, and expertly flicked the bottle on the side of the table. We all laughed in surprise as drops of beer ran over the side of the bottle and onto his hands. The room smelled like a party. We poured some of the deep brown brew into a small cup and handed it to the patient's wife, who slowly wet her husband's dry lips. He licked his lips and closed his eyes as he tasted the beer. Is that okay? I asked. My patient gave me a thumbs up. I wished that I had known him better. Cheers, he said. Bottoms up, I replied. A few days later, my patient died in that room. There were no more procedures. I didn't save his life. I thought again of that first taste of Guinness I'd had while a medical student visiting Ireland. When you first sip a Guinness, you taste something crisp, but there's also the bitterness of hops, and then behind the bitterness, the scent of caramel. And now, years out of medical school, when I think about being a doctor, I think of adrenaline and a rush of decisions and that hope of saving lives. But I also think of that moment in the hospital room. Love, a smuggled beverage shared around a bed, alarm silenced, curtains closed.
And thank you, Dr. Lamas, for doing that reading for us. And when my mom was ill and dying, she had always tried to convince us she had given up smoking. We knew she didn't. And this nursing home wouldn't allow cigarettes. And so I would come in, her favorite son, because I was the youngest, and that's just the way it was. And I think I was because, well, what I did for her is what I'd always done for whatever she wanted. And she wanted those cigarettes. And so I smuggled them in, and we went outside, and we would go out late, midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, and I would get out that cigarette lighter, and I would fire it up, and she would just take a long, deep drag off those more menthols. Nothing in the world made me happier. And there was a nurse Ratchet there that would have killed me if she found out. She would have killed me. And now we go on to some other storytelling. And this, on the 90th celebration of his birthday, the founder of Amway, Rich DeVos. We did a celebration that was terrific. We talked to so many people he knew. What he took the most pride in, by the way, was making so many people so much money. And by the way, it wasn't just the money, it was the independence. He gave them the opportunity to pursue their dreams. And so many women who before this just didn't have the opportunity and weren't seen as entrepreneurs. Well, he made a speech in 1966 called Selling America. And he did it to a group of young leaders in Canada. This was a worldwide business. And it was nascent. Let's take a listen.
And this is what you're going to hear, you know. Why, this is a rotten society today, folks. Did you know that? That dog-eat-dog free enterprise system. Why? Well, that's out of date. This is the age of socialism. This is a new age where we're concerned for our fellow man. This dog-eat-dog trying to outdo the other guy and make a better product and outsell him. That's just not anymore. That's what millions are saying in this country, aren't they? But you see, what disproves all that is that despite this so-called selfish attitude we're supposed to have, last year the American people reached in their pockets and gave $10 billion away to help somebody else. No, you see, the average American that I know is concerned for the welfare of his fellow Americans. And he works towards that end and he gives to the causes that will help them. And so the next time somebody tells you our system is not conscious of the welfare of others, then you remind them that it's more conscious of it than any other group of people on earth. I don't find any Red Cross or United Community Fund campaigns going on behind the Iron Curtain these days. I don't see them enjoying the things we have, and neither do you.
And there's so much more. Just go on YouTube or Google Rich DeVos and Selling America. What a great speech. And by the way, we should sell America to Americans more often. The story, the value system. And that's what we do here on Our American Stories. In the end, we're telling stories that others aren't telling about the greatness of this country and American exceptionalism in the end. And by the way, the good, the bad, and the ugly, we don't mask over the bad stuff. But my goodness, in schools around the country, that's all they talk about now. So we like to highlight the good as well. Again, this is Our American Stories. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to hear all that we do. More after these messages. is Our American Stories, and we're doing a live best of tonight. And we love to dig into the archives. We love sports, and we love father-son stories. And this combines both. Rediscovering My Old Man in the Sea was in the Wall Street Journal. Writer Keith Blanchard wrote it. And he brought home much more than a fishing trophy from a trip to Mexico with his dad.
Among the most beautiful words in the English language are certainly home and family. Bacon is a contender, too, in some circles. But to sports fishermen, no words are more beautiful than fish on, an adrenaline-fueled exclamation that they shout across the back of a boat when something has at last found its way to their hooks. I've been deep-sea fishing since I was too small to remember. My dad, my grandfather, and I would steam out at least a couple of times each summer from Barnegat on the Jersey Shore in my grandfather's 40-foot fishing boat, Sea Doll. My grandfather was always on the hunt for a trophy sailfish, back when the sea was still thick with such things. And he and my father had fished all the way out on the continental shelf for years, staying overnight and sleeping in shifts so they wouldn't be run down by freighters. But when I came along, they stayed responsibly closer to shore, hunting striped bass and settling, sometimes, for the much maligned Atlantic bluefish. These were all sea monsters to the preteen version of me, with their slack jaws and unblinking eyes, flipping over and over on the deck and skidding and slip-sliding into the hold. I'll never forget the raw anticipation I felt when our boat slipped free from the dock in the early morning when it was still dark, foam churning behind us to the thrum of the motor as we pushed North America away behind us. But kids grow up, and life moves on. My grandfather passed away, his boat was sold, and over time I kind of lost touch with both my old man and the sea. And so, decades later, right around the time I turned 40, I decided to stop thinking about it and to organize a father-son fishing trip. It took my dad about 3 seconds to say yes. And what would we fish for? Well, the ocean is filled with wonders. But deepwater fishermen all share one bucket list catch, the marlin, king of the sea. And so my dad and I, with my good friend Roddy, an experienced marlin hunter, found ourselves motoring out past the chalky crags of Baja California's Pacific coast, 3,000 miles and a world away from New Jersey's Barnegat Bay, on the first day of a 3-day fishing trip. Out of the ghostly marina at dawn and into the cold, dewy air of the Pacific. With the ceremonial first beer a little later, we drank a toast to my grandfather, and Roddy gave us the brief. A cross between a shark, a unicorn, and a freight train, marlins often weigh more than 200 pounds, though some monsters are much heavier, and can swim as fast as a car, leaping majestically out of the water when trying to throw a hook. And they're Neptune's own serial killers, eating anything they can smack and stun with that bone-hard bill. They're also smart and worthy opponents that work hard to stay out of your boat, thrashing and slicing at your line with their bills, even fouling your lines by swimming under the hull. Hauling one can take an hour, sometimes much more, of focused work. Your job is to keep that rod bent, reeling in the line when the fish will let you. A few hours in, we lucked out. Fish on! My dad slid into the fighting chair, set the pole, and started winding away. At several points, I jokingly offered to take a shift, but he just growled and continued his determined struggle, ultimately reeling in a nice one, 160 pounds and almost 7 feet long from the tip of the bill to the fork in its tail. We took our proof of triumph photos and released the fish to help keep the population healthy. Later, we celebrated at a bar, where I became acquainted with the awkward feeling of drinking with one's father while busty waitresses wearing Pancho Villa-style shot glass bandoliers trot around pushing drinks. I was ready to hook my own trophy, but the second day was more like a nature cruise than a fishing expedition. We saw dolphins and sea turtles and two whales that surfaced together right in front of our boat. Our only fish-on moment came when Roddy hooked a hump-headed, bottle-green mahi-mahi. Back to shore we went to eat our humble, delicious catch of the day. Our third and last day broke cold and overcast. Good fishing weather. The hours ticked by with all of us staring hopefully at the end of the rods, but we just couldn't will that telltale bounce into being. By the time we turned for home, I was at peace with it. A bad day's fishing is still better than a good day at work, right? Then, suddenly, just as we were about to pull up the lines, fish on! I scrambled into the chair and focused hard while my proud dad snapped photos like a maniac. And then the sharks arrived, circling the boat in anticipation of what we were about to reel in. Sharks love marlin, especially when humans have helpfully hooked them. The boat's crew bravely, or was it insanely, leaned over the stern and smacked one away with a bat and pulled another out of the way with the hook of a long-handled gaff. My muscles were in agony and my reeling hand blistered up. I was functioning on pure adrenaline, feeling every inch a soft and pudgy city kid. At one point, my prize leapt out of the water and flashed me those beautiful stripes. Would this marlin be that coveted middle line for my tombstone? Born, caught marlin, died, or the dreaded one that got away? Today, my Marlin, a fiberglass replica of it actually, hangs on my office wall. My dad's replica hangs in his house. Mine was slightly smaller than his, as he will remind you again and again if you let him. Every time that giant memento inspires questions and I get to tell my story, our story, I picture my dad doing the same thing, and it brings a smile. A bad day of fishing beats a good day at work, but a good day of fishing beats almost anything at all.
You bet. And that's Keith Blanchard again, his column in the Wall Street Journal, Rediscovering My Old Man and the Sea. And the last best of the day is a story we did almost 7 or 8 months ago, but we keep getting asked to do it. And this is an excerpt. It was a story of Robert Plant, and we pick up that story right after his drummer has died. Earlier, not too long earlier, his son had died, and Led Zeppelin was no longer a band. He was lost. He had to rediscover himself, and he does by coming to America a second time. Take a listen. And after a decade of pretty much being lost musically, drifting in and out of various styles, it turns out Plant needs to come back to America a second time, but this time not to the Delta, where he discovered blues, but to Nashville and to the folk, country, and gospel traditions that inhabited that region.
I found that there was more stuff underneath the covers going on, and it was still coming from Ireland and places in Tennessee and in the mountains where people just hadn't moved on. Families lived there for five generations without shifting from one township, so the music followed down through the families, and we got really old songs there.
In 2010, Plant, along with the Band of Joy, he'd won a Grammy with Alison Krauss just a year or two before, performed live for the BBC and closed out their show with this song, one you wouldn't expect from the lead singer of Led Zeppelin. And as it turns out, this is a song Plant had wanted to sing for a very, very long time.
I finally got my way after so many thousands of years of saying, why don't you finish the show with a song that says everything? And tried to sell the idea to a few people down the line, but we've got it now, so. Lay down, my dear sister, won't you lay and take your rest? Won't you lay your head upon my Savior's breast? But I love you, but Jesus loves you the best. And I bid you good night, good night. Good night. Oh, I bid you good night. Good night. Good night.
One of these mornings bright and early and fine.
Good night. Good night.
That was Plant in the first verse, singing along with some of the best Nashville voices. And a little bit later, the curtain pulls back and a gospel choir appears. And this is how the concert closed out.
Lay down, my dear sister. Won't you lay and take your rest? Won't you lay your head upon my Savior's breast? 'Cause I love you, and Jesus loves you the best. And I bid you good night, good night.
I was walking in Jerusalem just like John.
Good night, good night.
I was walking in Jerusalem just like John.
Good night, good night, good night.
That was the bad boy of rock and roll, singing the song he'd wanted to sing all his life on the stage, never having felt comfortable in his own skin, and having a bunch of bandmates who thought it utterly ridiculous to sing a song so beautiful. And have you ever heard something so beautiful from Robert Plant? Sometimes you need to be in your 60s to figure out who you are. I bid you good night. Well, we looked it up. We tried to find the writer. There isn't one. Like so many great old gospel songs, it's just a traditional ballad. He had heard it in the hills of Scotland. And how many young people had heard it in the hills of Appalachia? No difference. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, the life of Robert Plant, his art, his music, and so utterly connected to the American story here on Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib. We'll be right back.